Welcome to the inaugural show zero of the Babylon podcast. My name is Summer Brooks.
I'm going to put that on and go into the spot factory and get to work.
My dog and I are being attacked by a duck.
I think I'm kidding, but I'm not.
When you're hungry, you're hungry.
The Virgin sits on a crate opening and closing his pipe.
Steph has a mind of its own tonight.
I didn't get any entries at all.
Telepaths against mundanes is no contest.
I like Day of the Dead.
I did too.
Hey guys, it's Gary. I'm listening to episode 1.
And God help us all, this is Joe Truman.
Production of the malt liquor beverage Zima.
Nice and close, and I looked at him like, oh, do you want?
Hey there. Okay, I'm... Actually, let me call you back in a minute. Bye.
Stella, I knew it was a bad idea to record you. I knew it was.
And welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I'm Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And I'm laughing my ass off here. We have Jason Davis from Babylon 5 Books with us.
Hello.
And
it's not just Jason Davis, it's the Jason Davis.
Oh, pardonnez-moi, the Jason Davis.
There are a lot of us.
Oh, I'm just cracking myself up.
We are all Jason Davis.
We are all Jason. Oh, that'd be scary. That's
you have
scary.
No idea.
That's scarier than everybody being Summer.
Yeah, that was pretty scary too, in of its own self. Well, Jason agreed to come on the show tonight. First of all, we're going to talk a little more about Artifacts from Beyond the Rim, the latest book from the Babylon 5 books team, and then he's going to join us to Deep Geek on Racing the Night. But Jason, I've been spending the last week or so, more than anything, doing bibliomancy with Artifacts, just kind of opening a page and seeing what comes out at me.
And how has that been for you?
It's been amazing, actually. It's like every page, even when I think it might have something that I think is something that I've heard before, heard Straczynski talk about before, there's always, at the very least, a new wrinkle. And then I find I've wasted about 15, 20 minutes of my morning where I should be, like, putting my shoes on to go to work.
I don't think the word is waste.
No, well, reallocating, shall we say.
That's better.
It all depends on how his boss feels about the time.
Yeah, right. Well, some of that's changed here recently, which is a good thing. But anyways, that's neither here nor there. It's touched upon in the introduction about where all this material comes from. But Jason, I get the sense that you were the eyewitness. You were the Max Eilerson on the scene when all this was unearthed. Is that true?
I was indeed the Max Eilerson on the scene.
So
wading through cobwebs and coughing on dust and probably shortening my life by a substantial margin to find these wonderful treasures that we bring to you in these books.
So was it literally boxes underneath other boxes, or what was the situation? Give us the scene.
It's a storage facility out in the middle of nowhere. You raise the garage door and there's nothing but boxes floor to ceiling and big giant spiders and cobwebs and lots and lots and lots of dust. And this is where all the old Babylon 5 records have lived since the shutdown of the production office in Sun Valley in 1999 after Crusade was canceled. And we went there looking for Crusade material and found some Babylon 5 material while we were at it. And that's where Artifacts from Beyond the Rim comes from. That was a way to get that material out there. Material that would have been in the Black Series books, the original script books, if we'd had it at the time, although it would have required another volume, as you can tell by the sheer weight of what's there.
Right. What was Joe's response when you dragged all this stuff out into the light?
His response is usually, good Lord. that's the standard response whenever we dig up something that's, long forgotten.
Right.
We were looking for some way to celebrate the anniversary as well, because it's been 5 years since B5 Books started.
Right.
And this proved a nice thing to put in there while we were waiting for the attorneys to deal with the Crusade stuff.
Oh?
Well, yeah, as we said previously, everything has to be checked over with regard to the Crusade books, because it was such a tumultuous experience. with TNT. So, you know, we were looking for something to fill the gap there between volume one and two while we were waiting for things to come together, and that proved perfect because we had all this material, and we were wondering how we could get it out.
What to you was the most eye-opening artifact or item that you found in all this as you were going through it?
My favorite's probably the movie treatment, which was written right after the fifth season of V5 and was meant to be a theatrical film. And Warner Brothers wasn't interested in doing a V5 movie at the time, so it got shelved, and it's, you know, something that's never been seen before. It's probably the richest supply of new story material that you'll find in the book.
Right.
Incidentally, I have a message to pass along from Captain Jacqueline.
Uh-huh.
And that is, if anybody who ordered the book during the first 7 days, which would be up to October 27th, did not get the two postcards that were supposed to come with it, please email help@b5books.com. That's help@b5books.com. And tell them you did not get your postcards, and they will take care of you there.
Gotcha. The postcards are nice, but, you know, people, even if you don't order it to get the postcards, or you're ordering it after the time there, get the book. I mean, it's really... Jason, this is the one thing that I found most fascinating about this were the note cards in Joe's own hand, which are only partially legible. I'm impressed. Did you have to do the transcription on that?
Yes, I did the first pass of the transcription.
Wow, then I am.
Jan looked over them for anything I couldn't figure out. And then my wife looked over them, and then the proofreader looked over them, and then any questions that remained went to JMS, which I don't think there were any on that one.
Gotcha. I think one of the things that I found most interesting about that, especially with the notes, Joe's gone on record as saying that one of the things he wanted to do with all the ancillary stuff around Babylon 5, even during the production, was to demystify the television production process. And even with the script books, you know, you get a sense of how fluid the story was with Babylon 5.
Oh yeah.
But this in artifacts, it's like there are story segments, there are ideas for arcs that never got used, and it's really, I don't want to say that Joe was making it up as he went along, because clearly that's not the case, but I think I personally have always had a sense that maybe he didn't know every little detail, but most of the episodes were there, and he was just basically filling in the details.
You go in with a general battle plan. You're going to attack this front on this day, that front on that day, and then, you know, what actual soldier is on the firing line gets decided at the moment.
Right. This is
a ridiculous military analogy.
Right. But this is even almost like, I mean, here's a note here. It just says, Sheridan falls for a woman who did crime, mind-wiped revenge types come after her. He stops.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
an early take at the story that became Passing Through Gethsemane.
Right, exactly.
And that's a standalone episode, though. So that's, you know, that's not part of the arc as a whole. So those standalone episodes were really movable pieces.
And yeah, I guess
the execution of the idea can change quite a bit.
Right. But that was just to see how malleable all that material is. Well, even, I mean, there's the strange exhibition of Sebastian Dark, which ends up becoming Comes the Inquisitor, ultimately.
Yes, after many changes.
Right. And so it's just amazing at how malleable it was, even as the process is going on. That just was really fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to see what stayed and what went and what was added along the way. I mean, you have in the book all of the note cards for the version of season 5 that was conceived after Claudia Christian left the show.
Right, and after the notes got tossed at Blackpool.
Right, which would have been the original with Claudia Christian notes. So, again, he would have had to change them one way or the other.
Right, it's true.
But these, even then, which is, if you think about it, at the outset of season 5, there were so many ideas that were percolating and possibilities at that point, some of which just didn't happen.
Right.
There's one three-part arc that I won't spoil for people who are looking forward to getting the book that about midway through the season, which I think would have been really interesting if it had happened.
Yeah, I know the one that you're talking about.
Yeah, and there's mention of that in the volume 15 to the original scriptbook series. It's mentioned in the, I think, the Babylon Prime outline. Mm-hmm. That idea is there, so clearly it was there for a long time, and it just never found its way into the show.
Right. Anyways, I just it's a fascinating book. I mean, really, it isn't. It does not feel like a bunch of odds and ends that were just found and tossed together to get something out there. There really is an amazing wealth of information here.
Yeah, I'm very proud of the amount of stuff you'll learn about the show that you wouldn't have known any other way when you thumb through it. I mean, some of the stuff in the character profiles is a lot of fun. You know, whether it counts as canon or not is, you know, anybody's guess. But they were written by a member of the writing staff, and they have all sorts of interesting tidbits in them.
Yeah.
Same for the piece on the telepaths that explains various telepath abilities and how the Psi-Corps does their ratings and whatnot.
Right. It's almost role-playing material.
Well, you know, Larry DiTilio had a background as a role-playing game writer.
Right. Exactly.
Makes sense. And the patches, I'm really pleased we were able to put those in there. They're very nice. Those would be the patches that appear on the uniforms.
Yes.
And again, if you get the book, you get the URL to the top secret page where you can see those in color. Mm. And I won't spoil that, but I'm looking at it right now, and it is very neat to see them in full color.
Mm-hmm.
I made the mistake of not actually noticing that there was a URL there. So Jason had to like, it's right there. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did actually, I have Jeffrey uncovered a handful of those that we distributed between me and Brett and Tim. So seeing big color pictures of them is very nice. I think my favorite part is the telepath story, the telepath arc rather, and the Psi-Corps manual. I think somebody should actually go ahead and do that just because, you know.
Yeah, it would have been fun.
Call it unofficial so that, you know, there's only so much grumbling Warner Brothers can do. I don't know how much more grumbling they can do, because I think it would have been a great companion piece to go with the security manual, because the security manual has a great bunch of Garibaldi-ish humor in it. And I would have loved to have seen what they would have done with the Psi-Corps manual. I mean,
well, yeah, and the fact that Joe was going to write it would have made it even more interesting.
Yeah.
Whether he did it anonymously or not, which is one of the comments in there that he might have done it anonymously.
And I still would have loved to have seen if we got some, you know, Bester level snark in there, or the the propaganda-like tone that we saw in the Psi-Corps ads.
I'm sure there would have been a lot of that.
Oh, could you see a Psi-Corps manual done in the style of
ad that they had in Now for a Word?
No. Taking it to the next level, like the Heinlein movie. I'm drawing
Starship Troopers.
Starship Troopers, yes.
Yeah.
Can you see that level of propaganda-ish in the book? That would have been so much fun.
That would have been fun.
An opportunity was missed.
Well, unfortunately, toward the end of the run there, they weren't interested in capitalizing on Babylon 5 from a merchandising angle as much as one would have liked.
I know.
Set. And that's one of those things that turned up that I thought, oh, you know, that's a neat little document showing what Joe was interested in doing. And it wouldn't have been cool if it had gotten made. So I thought, why not just show people the memo explaining what he wanted to do, you know?
Now, Tim might know this better than I did, because I have no idea. When did the Star Trek novels start being published? Because I know there was a big Star Trek drought between the series and the first movie.
Well,
it was the mid-70s.
Yeah, it was the mid-70s. I want to say in the early 70s, there was a fanzine that published a lot of fan fiction, and then they put together a couple of anthologies of some of the best of that, which wasn't particularly good except for one or two stories. It wasn't until the official – I want to say it really wasn't until about the time that the motion picture was on the horizon that they started cranking out the novelizations that now clog your used bookshelves.
Yeah, now I think the James Blish novelizations of the episodes were earlier than that.
But yeah, and that came out concurrent with the series. Yeah,
original novels came around the time of the motion picture, and then more and more and more, and as they added more Next Gen and DS9, they all got their own lines, and eventually you can't, as you say, clog the shelves of the used bookstore.
Yeah.
So are you suggesting, Summer, that it's time for the Babylon 5 books to make a resurgence now that it's been 10 years since the show ended?
Given that we're not likely to see as many of these storylines explored in visual medium as we like, why not? You know, we don't have to go full whole hog and like put out 10 books a year, you know. A trilogy every 3 or 4 years would be cool with me. I could live with
it. As long as they're done to the quality of the Technomage trilogy or the Thycor trilogy or the Centauri Prime one, I agree with you.
Yes.
What would it take for B5 Books to get a hold of the rights to reprint those?
More money than Warner Brothers can imagine.
It would be a very complicated thing.
Okay.
Now, if anybody out there has any contacts with Warner Brothers book publishing unit, hey, I am still unemployed. I can make phone calls all day long. I have no problem calling people and asking questions and saying, hey, can I help?
Let me just say one thing. We wouldn't rule out doing Babylon 5 books as a possibility. It's something that we have considered, and there's been thought in that direction.
I mean, even if you get the permission to do new fiction, that's at least one giant step towards getting the other books either getting the rights to them reassigned so they can be republished, or maybe interest at Warner, Warner Books to be republished. Either way is fine by me.
It would be wonderful to get all those things back into print.
At least the outer print copies of the trilogy novels, because having one of the Technomage trilogy be unavailable and one of the Centauri trilogy unavailable is mind-boggling to me. Completely.
They still turn up in used bookstores, huh?
Not in used
bookstores. Not anywhere around Richmond.
I bought the third Centauri book in a used bookstore 3 weeks ago for cover price.
I should have, like 2 or 3 months ago, I held it in my hand. I said, I put it back, and I walked back around there like 20, 30 minutes later, and it was gone. I blame myself for that, for not holding on to it. And not having Twitter on my phone to say, hey, is this the one that's out of print or not?
Right.
That was my only hesitation. But yeah, I mean, because otherwise it costs like $50.
Yep.
Now, the other one that I'm curious about, The Parliament of Dreams collection of essays that was published in the UK.
I've never even seen that.
It mysteriously showed up on my doorstep in a box that was addressed from Jacksonville.
That's my book.
That's what I was told, actually, and I'm going to wear cotton gloves now to read it. That would be one I'm wondering if the B5 Books team might be able to reprint that, because that's not a Warner's thing. It's a collection of
academic essays.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I don't know. I have no idea on that one. Like I said, I've never even seen a physical copy of it myself. I just saw Dining on Babylon 5 for the first time the other day.
Really?
Yeah. I haven't seen that one yet either.
I have that one too.
Jason, you guys either need to find a rich, crazy benefactor or rob a bank.
We're working on that sort of thing. Not the robbing the bank part for legal reasons, but everything that you're bringing up is something that's been discussed at some point or other, and it's just a matter of when and if and how.
Gotcha.
We rule nothing out. Everything is possible.
Yeah, and frankly, the things that we're talking about are fairly obvious too. You know, I mean, it's like the B5 fan wish list.
Yeah, you haven't mentioned the short stories yet, so I'll go ahead and say we're working on those too. Hopefully, one day.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, right.
That's something. Those are all things that have all been discussed. They've all been looked at, and hopefully, one day.
Okay.
One thing I want to clarify: the postcard situation that I was talking about earlier. It's if you ordered multiple books, they sent you one set of postcards, apparently. So if you ordered 2 books, 4 postcards. If you ordered 8 books, 16 postcards. So
gotcha.
If you did not get your full complement of postcards, that's help@b5books.com.
Very good.
I was on that earlier.
No, not a problem.
And okay. It's also worth mentioning that the book goes out of print January 20th, 2011.
There you go.
So get your copies while they're hot, because if they're not hot, they're not there.
Get your Christmas orders in now, people.
Oh, and can I just say one other thing before we head for a break? I'm comparing the patches that are shown in the book with what's on the website, and there's stuff on the website that's not in the book, people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Get your book so you can see the extras.
They're pretty.
Yeah, very good. Well, I think it is time for us to take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll do some deep geeking.
I'm Michael R. Menengay.
I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Michael Stackpole.
And I'm Brian Brown.
Join us for an exciting romp through literature and books.
Romp? We're not romping.
We're supposed to be cool.
That's smooth. Right.
Okay.
It's the cool
it's
soothing
the
sounds.
Smoothing sounds.
The smoothing sounds.
I don't know, but romp just brings forth images of Michael in tights, and I'm so not going there.
Well, which Michael?
It doesn't matter. Neither one would be very good.
If you would like to join this thing that we do every week, it's called Dragon Page Cover to Cover.
Take two. Welcome to Dragon Page Cover to Cover, where the elite meet to discuss literature.
Okay, let's go back to the tight images.
Yeah.
Dragon Page Cover to Cover, where you'll never know what you're going to get next.
Digging down to the minutest arcani of the B5 universe, this is Deep Geeking.
This is the year we finally get to crusade.
Well, back then, by my calculations, it was going to work out that way.
I know what you mean.
But yes, we finally get to Crusade. And Jason, I don't know if you're aware or not, we ran a poll on the Babcast website as to what order we should discuss the Crusade episodes in.
Yes, and my least favorite order won.
Really? What's your preference?
Well, here's the thing about Crusade. There are a number of orders. There are a number of orders that have merit for one reason or another. None of them work. There is not a single perfect order to watch Crusade in. If you watch it in the best story order, there's dates that don't line up correctly that appear on screen. If you watch it in the order of the dates that appear on screen, the costumes don't work right. So I've come at it from every angle, because when we were putting together the books, we were debating what order to put the scripts in. And as you'll see, if you have Crusade, What the Hell Happened, Volume 1, available at b5books.com, yep. You will see that we did Racing the Night first, which, you know, it didn't air first. It wasn't produced first, but it was, in fact, the first script that Straczynski wrote.
Right.
So that's why it's number one. These books are going to present Joe's scripts in the order they were written. And that's an interesting order, because some of them were written, and then when the hiatus came and the show changed its format, some of them were then rewritten after that.
Ooh.
So, for example, Ruling from the Tomb changed up. No, sorry, not Ruling from the Tomb. Rules of the Game. Those two always get flip-flopped in my mind.
Right.
Was very, very different before the hiatus. It was originally supposed to be, I think, episode 7 or 8. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it ended up much later in the show. And much different. But
so, if you had to pick an order, what order would you pick? I've got the PPG to your head.
For discussion purposes, and this is the tricky fact here is, I've listened to enough of your deep geeking to know that you don't tend to dwell too much on behind the scenes stuff. It seems to me.
Right.
If you were going to do that, I would say approach them in the order that they were written, because that way you can deal with how things changed as the change occurs. In terms of discussing them just for the sake of the stories, really, I would go with just the original broadcast order, because, I mean, any order you choose is going to have flaws and it's going to have detractors. At least if you go with the original broadcast order, you're keeping continuity with how you handled Babylon 5.
Yes! That was my argument, too, but I lost.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's understandable, and the order you're using, I believe, is the JNS order that it was aired on Sci-Fi Channel, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, and then that order, the one flaw of that order, obviously, is that Warzone comes at the end because he just wanted it out of the way. I mean, if he had the option, I'm sure he would have said, don't show it. But, you know, Sci-Fi Channel paid for 13 episodes, they have to air 13 episodes.
Right.
Put that at the back where nobody sees it, hopefully.
Well, and it's interesting because when I was watching Racing the Night, there was this cognitive dissonance that I was experiencing as I was watching it, because part of as I approached it was, okay, let's imagine that this is the premiere episode for the show.
And it was intended to be.
Exactly, right. So you get expository information seeded throughout the dialogue, and it's done very well, but there's the other part of me that not only saw Crusade in the original broadcast order as on TNT, but I actually went back here recently and watched Warzone, just popped it in. And so I'm comparing the two as opening episodes.
Yeah.
And it did take a little bit of effort to set the one aside to be able to focus on the episode in front of me, which of course is Racing the Night.
Racing the Night is a much better pilot.
I agree. It's a much more interesting show, although Eilerson comes off as a completely two-dimensional cartoon.
You think?
Yeah.
In Racing the Night?
Yeah.
No.
Where he's Mr. Corporation, and he's there to get profit, and he says we can improve on some of the deal points. He has way more personality there. He just comes across as a coward in Warzone. Not to sound aggressive or anything. But
no. I'm like my comment wasn't.
Yeah. He has more to do in Warzone. I'll give you that.
Yeah, and it seemed too pat that he was the corporate guy who was all about profit, and profit and everybody else is like, well, profit's evil, and he's like, ha, you know, it's not evil. What else is there in the universe except making profit? And it just kind of all through it just seemed really, really flat.
No, it didn't come off like that for me at all. It came off as he's the genius. He thinks he's the most important part of the expedition, so everyone should pay attention to him. And if nobody cares that his agenda is discovering saleable items first, and, oh, by the way, yes, we're looking for a cure, you know, suck it. He's going to cover all his bases, and if they find a cure in the meantime, it's all good.
It's just great, right. Well, and let me say this by saying that David Alan Brooks' performance is excellent.
Oh yeah,
you know, I mean, there's a lot of great subtlety, and he's very expressive with his hand gestures. You know, that's sort of an idiosyncrasy of the character, that he does a lot of stuff with his hands, and I like that, and I thought that was good. I just think the dialogue that was written for him just wasn't up to scratch.
Did you read the first draft of the script that's in the
I didn't. And part of the reason was I kind of wanted to come at it with fresh eyes. Yeah, and I haven't even listened to the commentary on the DVD for that reason.
I missed on. I wanted to go. I wanted to watch the episode and then watch it with the commentary, but I ran out of time today.
I'll be curious to think what you think of Eilerson and Racing the Night after you read that.
I'll have to go back and do that then. Now, I did look at the Jan's comparison between certain scenes, and, you know, to get a sense especially of how Kulan is depicted differently in the original script versus what was actually shot. And I have to say that I like the shot version better, because one of the things that, well, for those who don't know, that the in the first draft of the script, Kulan's race is basically they're just testers. They just want to see who could be treated as enemies and who could be sucked in as friends. And Gideon says, well, we're not going to have any of that, and basically nukes the site from orbit, and they go on their merry way. Mm-hmm. And that's a broad. I liked how the final version of what was shown in the episode ties the whole thing, and this is one of the reasons why I agree with you. It's a better pilot because
it ties into the play concept.
Right, exactly. And it also gives you the sense that not only are our people looking, they're under the gun looking for a cure, they run into people who are also looking for a cure, but they've gone to extreme measures to try to find it. And it sets up that nice moral dilemma, which Gideon, you know, says, no, we're not going to go your route. You know, if we find something, we'll come back and we'll give it to you for free, but we're not going to become you.
Right.
Yeah, it brings up the historical parallel of Nazi experimentation in the concentration camps and whether you should be using the information they discovered, even if it saves lives.
Right, right. And so there's that juxtaposition, you know, and as Kulan says, well, you know, that's very noble, Captain, but let's see what your tune is in 3 years from now.
Yeah, that's the part that I liked. There was no judgment, you know, no accusation about what, you know, no anger or whatever about what Gideon had done to destroy their research ships. He's like, all right, if you're in our same boat in 3 more years, we'll see how you do. And it's actually 4 years because of the bet he made with the Drazi.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, okay, you want to gamble? Here's your gamble. If you don't find a cure by year 4, you spend that last year shooting down any ships that try to escape when desperation really sets in.
Yeah, because we don't want your people spreading this disease all over the galaxy.
And it's also worth noting that Gideon did not respond to Eilerson asking how many Narn lives are worth the lives on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he was thinking about it, you know.
Yep. And I don't know, I kind of like how it played with the echoes. You know, there are echoes in this episode that played with the moral question brought up in Deathwalker. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so yeah. Except instead of trying to be immortal, you're trying to save an entire race.
Yeah. Which is, you know, again, plays with that because it's a different thing than immortality, which is, you know, you can say from a judgmental standpoint, that's a selfish action to look for immortality. But to prevent the genocide of your race, that's a whole different ball of wax. One of the things that I found interesting in this pilot, and again, having only read parts of the first book of What the Hell Happened, knowing from reading that the original dictate to Joe was to tie it in as little as possible to the B5 universe.
Right.
Racing the Night is so insanely tied into the Babylon 5 universe. I mean, I guess if you don't know it, it doesn't detract from the episode. But
no, I mean, really the only obvious thing is the ranger that turns up in the tag to give them the next location. That's the only iconic Babylon 5 artifact there. I mean, but all the philosophical underpinnings are, of course, Babylon 5.
Well, that opening sequence, though, there's a Drazi, and there's a...
they're on Babylon 5.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, right, precisely.
Yeah, but they never identify it.
No, that's true. I understand that, but it just amused me that way. Now the one of the things that really struck me that I really loved with this episode was Mike Vahar's direction.
Mm-hmm.
And especially that opening flashback/dream sequence where Gideon is tossing in bed and you know, he's seeing the sepia toned recall of making that bet and what the Drazi and the Brakiri have to say about Captain Gideon and everything is from Gideon's point of view. The only time you see Gideon is in reflections of items that would be reflective.
Right. And he's even wearing a classic B5 Earth Force uniform.
Yes.
Reflection, which we never see him in anywhere else except for the flashback in Path of Sorrows.
Right. So it was just very well directed.
Yeah.
Very well intercut. Yes. Right.
And it's the same Bakiri ambassador who appeared throughout B5.
Mm-hmm. That's probably because they had the prosthetic already set to go, and absolutely, he wasn't doing anything. One of the other, let me get this one out of the way. The one thing that really struck me that, for whatever reason, didn't bother me with B5 watching on a DVD, that really bothered me in Racing in the Night, was the CG.
Really?
Yes. This time around, for whatever reason, it just wasn't as convincing. And I.
Now, wait, are you talking about the backgrounds or the little digital version of Galen?
No, that I loved the homunculus. I thought that was very clever.
Well, that was
and the dialogue for that was great. I hope nothing dreadful happens to me. Oh, look, something dreadful.
The CG for that little mannequin was awful, but I thought the CG.
But that was supposed to be awful.
For the
actually,
Sims.
It wasn't supposed to be that awful.
Yeah, it wasn't.
That's the thing that bugs Joe the most about that episode.
That was supposed that was supposed to be good.
He thinks the Technomages could make a better duplicate than that.
Yes. That was supposed to be lifelike. It wasn't supposed to look like a G.I. Joe doll.
Or a poser figure in animation. I just felt like a lot of the textures that were rendered on the surfaces weren't convincing.
Like specifically of the skimmer chase in Act One?
Yes, yes. That was the biggest one that I had issue with.
Yeah, I would tend to agree that the textures were not what they should have been. But then also you have to remember that they had just done A Call to Arms. Not that I'm apologizing for it, but I mean, going from A Call to Arms and then Racing the Night and doing all that CGI. Something somewhere had to not have the render time it needed, probably.
Sure. Well, then that could be. And I've also read where the transfers of B5 to DVD were real hit and miss. And I've seen corrupting. That in some of the... Yeah, okay. and I was just wondering if that might be the case here as well. I don't know.
No, Crusade looks as good as anything B5 can look on DVD. With the exception of the later things that were done in HD, like The Lost Tales. Because what happened was when they converted the B5 episodes to 16:9, they did not re-render the effects. They just blew them up. So effectively, you've got a case of less resolution being projected at a higher resolution. So it looks a little bit more hazy. And it's really bad whenever you have a comp shot where you have an actor walking through a CGI set. It's where it looks the worst. But because Crusade never had that 16:9 conversion, it looks as good as it can look, you know, at standard definition, pretty much.
So I'm glad you mentioned that about Call to Arms, because I'm sitting here thinking about it, and that was beautiful, and especially the Technomage scenes where Sheridan finds himself in the Circle of Stones,
right,
talking with the Technomages, and they pan up into the sky. Mm-hmm. You know, to look at the moons, and I guess there's another one where they cut to B5. Anyways, so I thought that was kind of weak. Now the other one of the other things that I thought worked really well was actually the bullet car. I think those exteriors, as it were, works better than any of the transport lift shots that were in B5.
I would agree.
You know, they just read better.
Mm-hmm. Bullet car's beautiful.
Yeah.
And the flashing of the lights as it zooms through, you know, that looks really cool.
I like the scene, you know, Galen, for all his apparent mysteriousness and his comings and goings and all the rest, I love the bit where he, gets in the bullet car and there's Darina.
Yeah.
You know, it's like nobody can keep tabs on Galen and he wants all mysterious, but Darina seems to know where he's going to be before he shows up.
I have two things to say about that. The funniest thing I had heard was I turned around and there was a Darina.
Yes. Yeah.
I absolutely love that. And I literally never noticed this before, but when she just appears, when he turns a corner, goes into a lift, and he gets that annoyed look on his face.
Like, you again.
Doesn't that remind you of the look Talia used to get on her face whenever a door would open and Garibaldi would be there?
Yeah.
Probably for the same reasons on some level.
Yeah.
That correlation just hit me today when I was watching the episode. I'm like, huh, I wonder if they did that on purpose.
I liked that there's apparently some history between those two that's hinted at.
Well, they had, you know, they had a couple of days together on Mars between Call to Arms and Warzone. So,
right. But
actually, no, because she ended up on Babylon 5 at the end of Call to Arms. So Galen had to transport her to Mars. So they were on his flyer for however long that takes.
I liked that interplay where he's basically telling her, I'm not going to teach you what you need to know or what you want to know because you're still too consumed with rage.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? You come to the end of the road, you can either turn toward fire or water, but you have to do that with a clear mind and an empty heart, or else the road goes nowhere.
And of course, that's all coming from a man who was nothing but rage after the death of his own girlfriend.
Right, exactly. Which is really nice. That's one of the reasons why the Technomage trilogy changed my opinions about Technomages in general.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a whole other discussion for another time. One of the other things that I really loved was Daniel Day Kim as Lieutenant Matheson.
Mm-hmm.
He was very businesslike, but he didn't seem cold. By comparison with what I've just said about Eilerson in the mm-hmm. script, he doesn't come off as two-dimensional. He comes off as a guy who's doing his job. And that scene where they're caught in the tractor beam, for lack of a better word, and Gideon orders the ship to turn around so the bow is pointing down, they can use the main weapon. And Matheson tells him, well, you know, we're going to be without power. And Gideon's response is very sarcastic. I read the driver's manual, Lieutenant. Matheson never blinks an eye. He's just, aye, sir, coming about.
He is exuding like, professionalism.
Yes, that's exactly right. Exactly right. He takes it in stride. I mean, he's as we know from watching the show before, that there's a history between he and Gideon, so he knows what his captain is about. But there's never a, you know, he doesn't even break a smile like, oh, my sarcastic captain. It's just like, you know, okay. That's just as good as saying make it so, and he just does it.
He has kind of a thankless role in Racing the Night. I mean, everything he does is to facilitate the action. He doesn't have any of the character scenes like Darina and Eilerson and Galen all have.
Right.
He's there issuing orders and receiving orders. And in fact, in the first draft of the script, he's just first officer.
Yes, right. I did notice that.
At all, yeah. And only after they cast the... Well, Joe named the character John Matheson. And then they cast Daniel Day-Kim, and then Joe asked, do you want me to change the name of the character? And he said, no, it's fine. You know, in the future, it's unlikely that names will be tied to certain ethnicities, so there's no problem with that at all. And that's how he came to be named John Matheson after Richard Matheson, the writer.
I think that's one of the most brilliant pieces in Crusade right there, is just the naming of that character with that ethnicity. Mm-hmm. Because there's no – and it doesn't come across as – PC or anything else like that. It's just, here's the character, here's how he looks, here's his name. It's a bigger deal that he's a telepath as the series plays out.
Exactly.
So, what else? What else can we say about this? Do you get a sense of the kind of captain that Gideon is from this?
You get a sense of what drives him. He is not willing to compromise his principles yet, but he's willing to push other people to find this cure as soon as possible. But he's willing to take certain risks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see that begin to develop a little bit, especially when we find out a little bit more about the Apocalypse Box. Because there we are at the end of the episode. We don't know what that is. And the way that Galen asked Gideon, this wasn't on the list. Where'd you get this planet from?
And I have my sources.
Yeah.
I'm sure you do.
And the way the box, you know, he says, that was a bad idea. The box says, hey, not my problem.
Yeah, right. Things change. Time goes by. What? You know, and one of the things that I really thought was interesting, especially when you compare that, you know, looking through the little bit of the script that I did, it's described as Gideon opens a drawer or a closet. But if you watch it on screen, it really looks like he's pulling apart a wall panel.
He's got a little secret panel there that had to
yes.
be built into that quarters.
Right.
Know, some contractor had to come in and put that in.
Right, right. And the whole point is it's that secret. You know, it's not just something he puts in the closet because he, you know, oh, I'm not going to leave it out on my desk, but I'll put it in the closet because I can get to it. No, he's got it in the secret compartment.
Yeah, I just want to know who installed the secret compartment. That bugs me.
What if he built it himself because he knew he would need it?
He could have. I could see that. But it's a very elaborate thing. You know, you push on it, it opens, and then that little tray comes out. You know, it's kind of fancy.
Now, I have one more thing to mention, and I was kind of surprised at this. Now, I'm one of the few people who has been on record for years now saying that I loved the soundtrack. I loved what Evan Chen did musically.
Bravo.
And I noticed a difference. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why I noticed it. I'm not sure if it's because I've been playing the Battlestar Galactica soundtracks while I'm doing some work, or listening to the few snippets of the Charlie Jade soundtrack that I have. And yes, I'm working on getting more of that. But it works. I absolutely love what he's done for the opening and closing themes. The way the music is paced, when you hear Galen's questions, it feels like the music is also asking the question. And then when that last question isn't answered, the music runs with it. I mean, the blending of those scenes and those voiceovers and that music in the opening is still, in my mind, brilliant. For the first time today, I noticed that the music didn't work during the battle. When the Star Furies and the Thunderbolts are fighting those drone ships, it didn't work. And I'm like, huh, I don't remember feeling this off kilter before. What's going on
here? That's interesting, because one of the things that I really am intrigued by Evan Chen's soundtrack is that in some ways it feels as much like sound effect.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just strictly music. And I think that's a very novel approach to that, and makes it very muted and understated. And in some ways adds to the unsettling quality of the show. Because, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, even with some of the criticisms I've had here with like Eilerson, some of that script overall, with the exception of maybe Dr. Chambers and Lieutenant Matheson, it's quite clear that everybody has something that they're toting with them baggage-wise, and that things are not what they seem. And I think the soundtrack helps to really make that point apparent, because it's not your usual swelling strings and heroic strains and martial music and drum beats and all that. It's this tonality, and I mean, it almost harkens to Forbidden Planet in many ways.
I'm okay with the tonalities. It's just for some reason this one battle scene, I don't mind being thrown off kilter, feeling off balance, but it didn't mesh. Even being with the off, because like I said, in Galactica, there's a feel of the music pushing you and pulling you while the battles are going on. And I'm going to have to pay attention to more space battles later on. Now, the elemental music is still working for me, but just that one battle, it was like there was something that was off that I couldn't put my finger on. And I'm like, maybe it's the music. And I never felt that before.
Yeah, one other thing that really struck me was the close-up shots of the Thunderbolt pilots with the dark reflections in the helmet. Mm-hmm. Made him look thoroughly inhuman.
Yeah.
And that was a really, really unsettling thing. I was not, there seemed to be no purpose to do that for the story, except for the sense of just kind of like upsetting the viewer.
Don't quote me on this, but I think that might have been stock footage from the bombing of Mars from season 3 of Babylon 5.
You know, now that you mention it, that seems about right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because they had the black face there.
Right, and it worked there because the whole point was that they were, you know, basically inhuman, unfeeling monsters bombing the poor Martian colonists.
Yeah. And also if you think about it, Mars has the same general color as Kulon's planet.
Right.
So the ambient light in the cockpit would be right. So I don't know for a fact that that's the case, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. Okay.
They just needed one more shot of a pilot that they hadn't grabbed during the. And they pulled that one because it matched the need. Because I don't think anywhere else do we see. I don't think we see Excalibur pilots with black face shields anywhere else in the series. I'm not sure.
Well, we'll know more. Yeah. Any last thoughts, guys, on this episode? What are you giggling about?
I think it would have been a great pilot if they'd let it be.
I agree. You know, in the end, it presents. Without really getting preachy, it presents the initial setup for the whole series. There's this plague.
Mm-hmm.
It ratchets up the tension immediately, so that as a viewer, you know, you expect 5 years they'll find it within, you know, in the last possible moment they'll get the cure, and there's no tension there. Well, they ramp the tension up because Gideon makes a bet that says we'll find it in 4, or I'm going to start killing my own people.
Mm-hmm.
We get the sense of the fact that this is not a new thing, and there is at least one civilization, and likely more, that have encountered it and not solved it. And you get a sense of at least 3 or 4 major characters and what it is that they might be dragging around with them that makes them very intriguing and not your run-of-the-mill space heroes.
And even the ones who don't get baggage at least have a nice moment to shine, so that you know what their personalities are and that you get across who they are as characters.
Right, right. So, yeah, it's a shame that wasn't the premiere.
Yeah, we could still have fun with it. And yeah. lament it. Well, we can do the lamentation after we've covered all the episodes.
And I'm sure there will be some confessions along the way as well.
All right. Well, you know the drill. Thank you, Jason, for joining us and geeking with us this evening.
Yes,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for the insights on Artifacts from the Rim.
Available until January 20th, 2011 at b5books.com.
Ding! Oh, as always, the website is BabylonPodcast.com. If you want to send in your emails, the email address is BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. Email in your questions, your comments, and all of your other fun, I don't know, tidbits, secrets. We all love little B5 secrets. You know, maybe you saw them hauling something away from the secret storage location, and something bounced off and fell off of a truck, and you picked it up. Who knows?
My precious.
I don't think so.
Hey, let us dream, man. Let us dream. And also the forums, farpointforums.com. Go over there, join in the conversation. Join in the conversation here at the website. Donate at the website because you love us as much as we love you. I know you do. Really? I know you do. And as always, the voicemail line to call in with your comments is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Here we had to figure out who we serve and who we trust.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.